Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 72 featuring Janelle Crosha. And I have my lovely wife, believe it or not, joining me on the podcast intro today. And it is, what day is it today, Karen?
It's Mother's Day.
It is Mother's Day. So we all should be celebrating our mothers today and making us the wonderful people that we are. I really appreciate that. Karen and I have been not together for a long time because I was at FMX, right?
It's been a while.
It's been a while. So I've been visiting a lot of people in Germany and in Switzerland, and it was an actually amazing trip. I recorded several podcasts there, so look forward to those when we get around to airing those episodes. But this episode features Janelle, who is a wonderful person. I've met her years and years ago at Digital Domain, and actually Karen and Janelle have something in common, which is they both used to own a 2004 Subaru WRX, which they both loved.
I did love my car.
Yeah.
I miss it.
You miss it? Well, luckily you can see it every time Stephen Parker comes by because he ended up buying your car from you.
That's right. I hope he's taking good care of my baby.
Yeah. It's a good car. It's a good car. It's pretty fun that you guys drove those cars because I think those are kind of the unusual cars for women to drive, generally speaking. You used to get a lot of looks from guys when you were driving that car.
There was always some excuse to come over and ask me something about my car when I was filling up at the gas station.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, yeah. It's a cool car. All right. So a lot of interesting things we talk about with Janelle. She was an incredible person over at Digital Domain and became a pretty important visual effects supervisor. And there's a lot of challenges to being a woman visual effects supervisor in the industry right now. Do you find that's true, Karen?
From my limited experience, yes.
Yeah, because you also...
I've supervised a few small projects, and it has come with challenges.
Do you think it's a challenge specifically because you're a woman?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say, but sometimes I get that impression.
Yeah, I think so too. And there's our cat meowing in the background. But I think that there are definitely some challenges, and Janelle sort of addresses some of them, and I think that there's something that we should all be aware of. I think there's actually... a feeling that people have that may not necessarily allow them to accept women to be in a position of power, and they don't even realize that they're not allowing that to do. It's sort of small levels of sexism, not direct sexism, even though people don't intend to be that way. And I think that that's something that happens within all, the entire industry that happens, and it makes it harder for women to be able to be confident at being a supervisor, and also make it harder for people to accept women to be supervisors without them even realizing that they're doing it in the first place. And I think it takes a lot of time to realize that. And I think that it starts with men knowing how to treat women with respect in the workplace. And that's something that that it needs to be learned, over time.
Possibly. I know that definitely there have been times when I felt like my direction was taken as more of a suggestion.
Rather than, this is what I want you to do.
Rather than, this is what I want you to do. It was, okay, that's nice, but I'm going to do what I think is right. And, of course, then that escalates to some conflict. And
right. And I think that, this is something that Janelle said specifically. She said, sometimes you say something and because you said it, because you're a woman, sometimes people say, oh, you're just being a bitch. And it's like, no, that's just, if I was a guy, you wouldn't say that.
Well, I certainly know that there's times that I'm maybe a little bit less likely to stroke somebody's ego when I'm giving them direction. And it definitely is taken differently from when I've had that same interaction with men that, for me not to consider somebody's feelings when I'm saying something all of a sudden makes me a bitch.
Yeah. And then I know I'm not.
Or makes me aggressive.
Absolutely.
Which is not acceptable as a woman.
Yeah. I don't know. I've always been very, I've always loved having women, actually, to be honest, that are in a position to help me in my career, be it through as a supervisor or as a mentor of some kind. I find that women are very good at that. But I also know that it's a challenge overall, and I don't know why there aren't more women available in this position. I know this. I'm not going to magically solve this problem because this is not just visual effects. This is the entire world of business.
Well, there's definitely certain industries that are more male dominated and others that are more female dominated. And,
right.
You know, when you're the outlier, there's always conflict, even if you're a man in a more female dominated career. I'm sure that that, you know, that's a, an issue as well.
Yeah. And I this is something I want to get to the bottom of. I also want to know why specifically, you know, is this an interesting thing? Why do you have more, there are more women are involved in production and coordination and producer roles than in visual effects as artists? And, you know, why is there a difference in that that happens, and sort of try to understand, because I certainly think women are perfectly capable of being fantastic artists. There's no reason why there shouldn't be more female artists available right now, especially in the leadership role. So a lot of things I'm trying to figure out, and I'm going to give myself, you know, this year to sort of try to come up with as many answers as possible to try to solve that, because I think that would be a good goal for us to get to the bottom of.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that gets to the bottom of our podcast intro. Hope you guys enjoy it. A lot more to come up. Sorry it's been a little bit late this week. I'm just trying to catch up on a few things. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has fur now.
You're looking fairly tanned and relaxed. Where were you, Janelle?
I actually live by the beach.
Oh, so you were at the beach.
Every morning I'm walking on the beach.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now that doesn't make any sense, because a lot of people live by the beach in visual effects.
And they're white as ghosts.
And they're white as a ghost. I worked at DD for a long time, two blocks from the beach, and nothing.
You guys got to get that vitamin D. It's important.
Yeah.
I supplement.
You supplement?
Yeah, 2,000 IU.
No real sunshine.
Yeah, but you don't have to deal with skin cancer then.
Mm.
Mm. But it's true, though. It makes you feel better.
I do wear sunscreen.
Yeah, well,
but
I'm sure you do.
You know, my mom is Filipino, Italian, and Portuguese.
So you don't really have to worry about
that. So I have some darker...
You have something that bronzes nicely.
Yes. There you go.
As opposed to just burn and peel. Yep. All right. Well, that's cool. So I'm thinking first time I sort of knew you, or I met you, was at DD during, you were working in commercials, and you were this cool chick that was driving a WRX.
Oh my God. And the reason, love that car.
Yeah, I know you did. It was an awesome car. And I thought it was really cool because my wife drives a WRX too, or did, and has since sold the car to the person sitting next to you.
Oh, really?
So he drives.
What do you think?
I drive the shit out of that car.
Awesome.
We drove around in yours, and I always liked that car. And then you sold it without telling me.
I sold it for very cheap.
Very cheap.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so you ended up buying my wife's WRX.
For twice as much.
Nice.
Well, because she knows how much it was worth.
It's a good car, though.
Yeah. You had a blue one, though.
I did.
Yeah,
I
the,
had a
classic,
blue one.
The classic
2004.
Blue. Yeah, yep. Same year.
Same
with
year.
Some cool same rims, some yeah. cool silver rims, and blue lug nuts.
Yeah, blue lug nuts. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, any modifications done to it?
Blue nuts.
It had some modifications. It had a... I don't really know what it's called. Like, it had a few kits that an ex-boyfriend put in, and then when we broke up, he took them out.
Oh, yeah. that sucks.
He took them out and sold them, so it went back to normal.
Oh, wow!
It was actually lowered a bit. It had tinted windows.
Yep.
Yeah, it was a good car.
Yeah,
good car.
Yeah, when you stepped out of it, everybody's like, "What the fuck?"
What? I'm from the mountains.
You just don't expect. Yeah, I know.
I'm from the mountains, so
yeah.
It actually
where
all-wheel drive was came in handy. I'm from Angels Camp,
right? Which
so
is
so that's sort of up near Yosemite.
Okay, in the Sierras, kind
of in the Sierra, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas.
Yeah.
So I
and it's
kind of
remote where you are. Very remote.
It's about 3,000 people.
Right, and treacherous terrain. It's not like you can see everyone very easily. Everyone's house is kind of like a little bit isolated.
It's true.
Right?
There's been a lot of fires lately, actually,
right.
Which is a little bit scary up there.
Mm.
But It's cool. It's about a 6-hour drive, so I make it up there quite a bit.
Yeah. Does your grandmother live there still?
My
and your sister's
entire
there?
Family lives there.
Wow.
I'm from a family of grocers, and my great-grandpa started the grocery store there in the 30s, and then my grandpa, and now my dad, and all my siblings are up there.
Wow. Grocery store. So like old-fashioned general store kind of stuff.
Yep.
Wow. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, my second life is going to be a grocer at some point.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think you're doing pretty well as a visual effects supervisor.
Yeah. I'll do this for a little while longer.
It'll do this until that gets a little boring. But so when you were, obviously you come from the commercial side of things. So you had worked with Eric Barba for a while, right? I'm assuming that during the commercial side of things, there was a lot of Eric Barba time, right?
Yeah. When did I start working with Eric? That was probably in about the year 2000.
Okay.
And we worked on an American Express commercial.
The blue ones?
The blue ones, yeah.
Right. Remember those? They were the middle American Express cars, but they were just like a blue card, and it had protection, and all these spikes would come out of it or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
So we did the one that was it was called Microsurgery, where the card, the little chip slides open, and then you zoom in. And I don't know if you saw that one. And then the other one was called Transformer, and the card actually turns into a transformer.
Oh, nice.
And so that was pretty fun.
Yeah. And you were a 3D person back then. You did some light wave stuff, right?
I was. Like on the Transformer one, I did the previs and the modeling and the lighting.
Yeah.
I didn't do the texturing.
And you were mostly light wave, right?
Yep, all light wave.
Where did you learn all that stuff?
I learned on the job. When I was out of high school, I moved to San Diego, and I went to Palomar Junior College, took some beginning Photoshop and graphic design courses. I'd always been an artist.
Yeah.
And from there, I was offered an internship that was an illegal internship. Like, this guy next to me was just like, hey, your work is cool. Like, why don't you show some of your artwork down here, and you can learn 3D animation. And I was like, what's that?
Yeah.
So I ended up showing him artwork, ended up basically becoming like a babysitter for the boss's kid and free receptionist.
Wow.
But on the job, just started to learn Lightwave.
That's pretty cool.
From there, from there, a bunch of the guys down there in San Diego actually ended up leaving and going to LA. And so the boss was like, here, can you make this baby head for this commercial? And so I taught myself how to model. And then it was like, oh, can you make this fish head? And it was like a talking fish. And so those were the first two things I ever did. So I was doing a lot of organic modeling. And then from there, the guys up in LA actually offered me a job, who had moved to LA.
And they moved over to DD at the time? Or where were you? Where did you go to?
I went to Threshold.
Threshold, I don't remember.
Have you heard of Threshold Digital Research Labs?
No. Now tell me more. It sounds so very interesting.
That was owned by a guy named Larry Kazanoff, who, we worked on Mortal Kombat Conquest, the television series. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that. Really? No, you haven't.
Yeah.
Really?
Sure.
Wow. It was actually pretty cool. It was like Matt Morgan, Jeremy Yates, all those guys have now been at Naughty Dog for like 15 years after they left Threshold. But it was pretty great because I got to be a generalist there. So I learned the composited and digital fusion, was doing everything from like some effects to texturing, even some rigging. Like, it was just a lot of, it was an episodic TV series.
What year was this?
Probably 99.
Okay.
And then around 2000, like shortly around there, I got a job offer from DD. Rob Niederhorst actually brought me over.
Of course.
And
Rob's been on this too.
Oh, has he?
Yep.
Awesome. And so, yeah, from there, worked with Fred Raimondi. Did like all commercials at DD during my first stints.
I was at DD starting in 2000. End of 2001. So you'd only been there about a year or so, I guess, or 2 years maybe.
Yeah, well, I left actually after those American Express commercials. I ended up moving to Hong Kong.
All right.
And I was a consultant for a kids TV show.
Okay.
at the time, I did it just for the life experience, sure. You know, more than anything. So Eric was actually a little pissed at me that I took off. But
he takes things personally sometimes.
He later forgave me.
Yeah, he feels like he did something wrong. What did I do to, you know, yeah. He yeah. takes things personally, which is fine. I think that's he's very protective of his team, of his talent.
He personally invests himself, so that
he does.
That's why he takes it personal.
Right. Yep. Yep.
But at the time, I was like, see ya. You know, Hong Kong, I'm here. You know,
yeah,
like, I'm going to go to Hong Kong. Yeah. It ended up being a little bit scary. I think I was 20. I wasn't even 21 yet in Hong Kong, trying to teach Lightwave. It was a little bit scary.
And English.
I was in a little bit over my head. They said that the leads knew English, and they did not know English at all.
Wow.
And so I was there for about 8 months or so. They wanted me to stay longer. I just was like, you know, ready to go. So I came back. I'm not sure at that point. I think I went to Foundation Imaging, I want to say. Or that was somewhere in there. I kind of get those years mixed up now. But I went to Foundation Imaging and did Starship Troopers.
They were over near Magic Mountain, Valencia, right?
Yeah.
They were doing...
Wait, say what you did?
Starship Troopers, the TV series is what I worked on.
Yeah.
And that was really fun. I learned a ton.
Chris Norption was there. Everyone was there. And Randy Sharp was there. Mm-hmm. And that's why all those guys still live all the way out there, because they all work for Foundation Imaging.
Yeah, it was good.
Aaron Vest, I think, was
those out
there.
Those were good times.
Yeah.
And did a lot of... There, like, my passion was lip sync. You know, we could go in and, you know, they had this little capture room where you would go in and just basically film reference and say the lines of any character. You know, there was probably about 8 different characters on the show.
Yep.
And then, you know, do the lip sync. And I kind of got to where I was doing like 4 or 5 minutes a week, you know, kind of hardcore lip sync, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was good, but it was a lot. but it was.
That's how you get good.
Yeah, it was. That was fun.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And then from there, went back to DD.
Okay.
So I always kind of kept. So going you were back to at DD.
I mean, I was there all the way through Stealth. So you probably just reappeared there at some point, I guess.
Yeah, and then.
But DD was kind of like I didn't. That was the other thing about DD, right? I was in feature side,
right.
And you were in commercial side, and those were like 2 different.
What features
worlds.
Were you on?
Just 2 different buildings. That's
well, not only 2 different buildings, but also 2 different like.
No, I know, but I mean, it kind of kept things.
Yeah,
separated.
I was on Day After Tomorrow, and I was on a movie that you were on as well for a little bit, which was iRobot.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was fun. I was on the environments team.
Yep.
For iRobot.
Yep. Yep. You were doing. Lightwave environment stuff on it. And I was on the character lighting stuff.
That was what, like 2003?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. And then on Stealth after that, which, that was not that much fun.
Aww.
And then I left.
No?
No, Stealth.
Shampositing?
Yeah. Shampositing. So just so people know, shampositing, what that is that you break out all of your shader components outside out of RenderMan at the time.
AOVs.
All the AOVs. And then you recomposite the shader. But it tried to give absolutely every control possible to the point where it was very, very easy to just break your shader and it didn't always look great. Or it gave like too much control. Like I remember people were relighting Nuke, and they would basically animate the lighting so that everything would be backlit the entire time, even though they were moving in a circle. And it was just like, something's not right. I don't understand. So I think it just gave too much control to that were not necessarily.
But you were able. I mean, how many shots are on that show? It's pretty. There's a lot of shots, right? That got
there
put
was,
through on
but
that
I don't
show,
think you needed to give.
I love this argument, by the way. So there's the 2 sides of the coin, right?
What?
Well, because Janelle's being the compositor right now,
right?
And you're being the 3D guy.
I just get what you get, and you don't get upset.
but Janelle's a control freak. And
she is a control freak. So Janelle, you were more of a compositor now, or at some point?
Well, now
right?
When I got back, I think I joined staff around 2003. It was somewhere around then. It was like 2003 to 2009.
Right.
And it was actually Eric Barba who. you know, said you should learn Nuke.
Right.
At the time, I was using Digital Fusion. We even used a little bit of Digital Fusion on the Nine Inch Nails video.
Oh, right. You were on the Nine Inch Nails video.
Yeah. And that one, so we used some Fusion to make displacement maps.
Right.
Fusion had these great audio controls that are probably still better than Nuke's.
Sacrilege.
And it, so we used a little bit of Fusion. We all learned 3D Studio Max on that show.
Yeah.
And around then was, you know.
Were you working in Max?
They were lightwave.
Just a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. They'd set up, we were lightwave, and then that was the first Max show.
The whole team moved over.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
So that was all Max, that show. And then I'm trying to remember, there was some Pontiac commercial after that. So I dabbled in Nuke just a little bit on that spot. And then I wasn't a fan of how the Flame artists were compositing my 3D elements on this Pontiac spot.
Okay.
And I just decided to learn Nuke. And so that's when I...
And Nuke at the time, that was still internal, right?
It wasn't... Yeah, it was internal. It was pretty rough.
I remember the old interface for that.
Well, when I start Nuke, what I do is I turn back to the old original interface.
Where you can't see anything.
Can't see anything. So it's just basically a
so
blank
slate.
So
you have more room.
Well, it's just like... And I double click on it, it opens up a window, and that's where it is. As opposed to when you have all these little controls on the side, it's like, I don't remember which one goes to which node, you know? So I want to control all that stuff. That's, you like the new interface because they try to make it look like Shake.
Yeah. I always liked Shake. I just thought it was slick.
I tend to always just evolve with what?
Whatever. Oh, no, it's true. Yeah, I'm not stuck on anything.
The smart people are like, here's the, you know, here's something we've worked on for a while.
I pretty much don't like anything
anymore. You know?
Right? You go from having a favorite to just eventually not liking any of them.
Yeah. That's true. But anyway, so you started, I guess, comping, I guess, must have been the Nine Inch Nails video.
Oh, so no. I started comping right after that. Yep. And so, we had to like melt down this jet engine. I made a bunch of elements that I knew would work.
That was the stealth thing.
It was a Pontiac commercial.
But it was based on like the stealth transforming the car turning into a jet. Like there was something.
That was Saab.
That was Saab. Okay, that's different.
That one we used Lightwave.
That one you used Lightwave.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I did do some compositing on that one. That was after.
All right.
But yeah, started to learn Nuke from that show on. Eric actually, you know, was just trying to push me into all Nuke. And so.
Right.
So I still, you know, for probably about another year with other supervisors would do 3D and 2D mm-hmm. and then started to do just 2D.
But you already understood the 3D, so you have a 3D background, so it gives you an advantage in 2D.
Yeah, and for as long as Lightwave was still going, it was actually great because I would just go make my own mats. I would, you know, it was just really helpful to do that.
Now you have to rely on idiots like us.
That's about the time when the industry as a whole was sort of moving away from, or becoming very, you know, the division of labor between, you know, 3D and compositing was starting to happen. Because when I started, I was, you know, comping my own elements, right? Like a lot of lighting TD,
you know,
was also doing comps.
I don't know. It's different philosophies because at DD, the compositors were always king, right? They were always king because of Nuke. And so 3D people would just do whatever the compositors ask. This is back during the early
days.
I don't think on Eric's shows, but in commercial, I mean, in feature size, for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so when I went to Sony, I was like, well, no, you comp your own stuff.
I'm
like,
yeah.
I'm not used to, I'm usually just going, here, you take it, because I'm not supposed to be in control. And the compositors were very, very much, I own this shot. I present the final shot. Mm-hmm. I do this. So I was like, okay. So it was different for me. And then obviously, I think it just kind of balanced out to the point where, you know, lighters would do light comps. So they would put it together in the way that it was supposed to be and then hand it off to the compositor to do whatever other, because they didn't want the lighters to spend a lot of time dealing with all the elements and green screens and all that other stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, in some cases, probably like in commercials, it probably made sense, right? For you to be handing stuff off to yourself, right?
Right,
there's
absolutely.
There's no delay in it at all. And I think that when the number of visual effects the shot counts in general started going up, it just made more sense to kind of pipeline it and kind of just let the 3D guys handle, or the lighting guys handle the rendering.
I think that
and compositing guys handle
now that there's more schools these days,
sure.
And you know there's more education going on, that it's kind of a known, you know, you're going to pick a department,
right?
Or it's more taught, you know, that where back then it was a little bit more of the wild wild west.
Well, and both areas just sort of became more complex, right?
Yeah.
Like just in terms of like color, like compositors having to deal with like all the changes that were happening in color pipelines and you know, moving over to, you know, digital cameras and that kind of stuff. And then the renderers became more complicated as well, right? So like it just made sense for you to just sort of focus and specialize.
Yeah, it's soon the renderers and the, you know, moving into Maya and, you know, when commercial switched over, it's like it was definitely too much to hang on to trying to continue to
keep up with everything.
Know how to do the 3D, you know, along with the comping.
Right.
But I enjoyed both. It was satisfying, right?
Yeah,
like it wasn't like just handing your stuff off for somebody else to just take it.
But the light comps, you know, light comps are so valuable, as are effects comps.
Sure. And,
sure.
You know,
it's like
I'm
this is what
a
it's
big
supposed to be.
Fan of you know, the compositor starting with those comps, you
right.
know, as much as they want to throw them away, it's like this is, you know, you have to refer back to that. It's really important.
Yep. 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 So the was Zodiac like one of your first features you were working on?
It was. Okay. I did a couple shots on Supernova.
Nice.
And then I think that iRobot.
Oh, right. That's correct. We did talk about iRobot.
Did a little bit of compositing on We on the Night and Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
I actually worked on a few features back at Threshold. The very first Beowulf.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like the old school one Nolan and Chris? No. Who's the gray hair.
I can't think
of him right now. The main actor.
I'm blanking.
It was Zodiac was like the first big one, you know, that I was on from start to finish.
Right.
So I was comp soup on that.
That's great.
And that was fun. That was some really challenging work.
Okay.
That was recreating, you know, San Francisco.
Yep.
Back when all the murders happen.
Yeah.
And so recreating Washington and Cherry Avenue up in San Francisco. And we ran that out of the commercial division, which
right.
was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that was because of the relationship, obviously, with Fincher and Barba, right? So that was the first big one. And then, obviously, the big one you did after that was Buttons, I believe, right?
Yes.
So that was a huge one. And your role in Benjamin Buttons was
compositing supervisor.
Compositing supervisor. That's a major role in that. And that's a lot. I know that when I spoke to Eric about you on that show, we talked about a lot about the significance of the importance of your role on that show.
Cool.
And I think it was interesting because what was one of the stories that happened a lot is, you know, obviously there's a whole bunch of shots were done, but the Uncanny Valley problem is a challenging one, and that's something that you're very familiar with, I'm sure, and you learned a lot on Buttons.
We actually learned a lot on Orville Redenbacher.
Yeah.
That was kind of the main...
Yeah.
This is probably repeating itself because Eric's probably said the same things.
No, actually, we didn't even mention
We didn't actually
Orville.
Talk about Redenbacher. Do you want to talk about
it?
I was going to bring it up.
He tries about that.
But well, we should explain that because, in a sense, it was a failure, but it was a huge learning process, right?
I think that was in 2005, mm-hmm. I want to say.
Right. So you had already done test, right? There was a test that was done on a Lightwave. Were you involved in that test?
No, just briefly.
Okay.
Right now.
Who was comping that one? It was
Sonia.
Sonia Bouchard, right?
Yep.
So anyway, but you had done the, so then what happened was, okay, we did the test. It was enough to go, I guess the studios go, right? And it was amazing. But then Fincher wanted to sort of kick the tires on the pipeline, on the process, and see how this is actually going to work.
Yeah.
And decided to do a commercial, because he has a commercial background, for Orville Redenbacher, and a lot of time and energy was developed to make that commercial.
Yes, it was. You know, it was the I forget who the ad agency was, but they were the agency who did those Burger King Big Head commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys remember those?
Yeah.
So they were really. They had this really strange aesthetic, anyway.
Yeah,
and they wanted it to be campy and weird. And
they're out of Colorado, I think. I forgot their name.
It just doesn't mix very well when, like, campy and weird with a digital human,
right.
you know, that you've never tried before. And
right.
so they had cast this lady instead of you know, instead of a guy, they cast this lady, and she really didn't have, like, her neckline wasn't the same. There was, like, so many things about her that it just wasn't cast very well. Mm-hmm. And she acted really animated and really stiff at times and then loose at others. And it was like she was in this, like, theater play, like, acting out. And, I just remember it. When we were getting into tracking the head on, and they would just be like, oh my gosh, like, you have to make his head not be so stiff and, like, you know, move differently, you know, and they really wanted to just break the neck, you right. know, and it I think that was the first time we really knew the importance of, like, okay, a tracking pipeline and getting, you know, how important it is to make sure that the head sticks on the body and mm-hmm. then that the actual performance is what you want it to be, because if the body performance isn't good, it's not that easy to change it. And then when you try to change it, it really messes everything up quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so those spots, actually, I think only one was released. There was actually three
right,
of them.
Right.
Really?
Yeah, but they, you know, there's a couple shots that look decent.
Sure.
But for the most part,
it was
part,
just weird for people.
It was just weird. It was like, you know, we knew that there had to be some sort of, you know, the body double underneath and then the facial capture, just, you know, it had to be evolved. Like, those pipelines had to
right.
be evolved, the tracking and the animation more than anything.
Yeah.
So it almost killed me because I was locked in a flame bay with black over the windows, just sweating bullets, like, oh my God, like, trying to fix this stuff in comp.
Right.
And there was just no fixing it in comp, you know, and so it was warping and, you know, pushing around this and that and trying yeah. to.
And just makes things worse.
You know, I mean, it helped it. It didn't
helps.
Make it worse, but it still was not good.
It's just hard. You know, that's one of the things about sometimes digital humans, is I always use this analogy, is like, when everyone knows that something's wrong, but no one knows what the actual problem is. It's hard to pinpoint what the problem is. And when you ask when something's wrong, you'll 10 people, you'll get 10 different answers.
Right. Well, because it's a culmination of a bunch of little things.
Yeah.
And you don't exactly use the scientific method when you're trying to address it, which is keep all things constant and just work on one thing.
Right.
Because you have to kind of move all the things around at the same time, because
right.
it's hard to isolate that one variable in the context of other things that are wrong.
Right.
So it's like, all right, I don't know if that little part of the eyelid actually looks okay because the rest doesn't.
Right. Right. I mean,
so it's a hard problem that you can't really.
And once you have a shaky foundation, you know, if the track isn't on, or even worse, if the performance isn't something that people like and respond
right.
to and,
yep.
you know, emote to, then it, then you're really kind of screwed,
yep.
you know, because no matter what you do on top isn't going to, you know, it's not going to connect.
So you took a lot of, I mean, obviously that was a lot of knowledge base when you walked away from that. How did you feel when that show was over? It was like, great, I can't wait to work on another digital human show.
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
I couldn't wait. Is yeah, it, Benjamin Button, I was just like, come
right,
on.
We've like, learned everything now.
We had a whiteboard, you know, in our office, and it was just like, how simple can we make this? Because it got so convoluted on Orville.
Yep.
And it was just so painful because nothing like that had been done before. And so you have the agency and digital domain literally with news crews in the parking lot going ready to press release this thing, and it's going to be amazing. And I'm going, what are you talking about?
What?
Like, it's not Orville Redenbacher.
Really? They had yeah, press there?
They thought that it was, people were going to freak out in a good way. And it was just like, it doesn't look like him, you know, like how this looks nothing like him, you
wow,
know. And so
I didn't know
people did freak out in a bad way, and they, you know, pulled it off.
Sure.
But, you know, so when Benjamin Button was greenlit, it was just like, okay, this, you know, we can't fuck around. Like, this is Brad Pitt. This is David Fincher.
Right.
Like, this has to be simple.
Well, you guys weren't fucking around.
Like, the way that we do this has to be really, really simple, you know,
right.
in a way where, I guess that's just, you know, my theory is just the more simple you can make it,
right.
that's, you know, the best results you're going to achieve.
Yeah.
Because anytime with digital humans that it gets too complicated, you know, you really want to let the computers do the work. You want to capture the set.
I could not agree with you more.
I mean, you know, it's like you have to, yeah. you have to capture really good data. The performance and the shoot has to be planned really well.
Yeah.
You know, the animation, it's like you want to try to automate it as much as possible,
yep.
and then just fine tune on top,
yeah.
so that it really is Brad's performance
yeah,
who's driving
you literally
it.
Are just digitizing a person and reassembling them, right? Like, that's what you want to be. You want to be, it's like,
it's
equivalent of taking, you know, an analog signal.
And it sounds like when you're saying that, it's like, oh, well, you want to take the power away from the artist, but that's not the case.
There's no art. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There is artistry in it, but you're putting it in the wrong place. Yep. Like, let the science part do the science part and let the artist part do the artist part.
It's the foundation, you know, it's just the foundation. Then the artists are what bring it alive, like 100%.
Yeah. And I this is something that I've, you know, I don't even know if you know about my whole WikiHuman project.
I don't.
I'll explain that to you. It's a similar point. But anyway, we're open sourcing Digital Human, and we're giving all this information now for free for people to learn on. So it's actually kind of really cool. But yeah, I should.
Based on ICT data.
Based on ICT data. So Paul is, you know, all those guys in ICT are doing scans of people or one particular person, and we're getting very, very high resolution data, and we're just giving that for people to.
That's amazing.
And showing them how to put it together themselves. Like, this is how you do it. Like, because ICT goes out there and they do all this stuff. They do all the science behind this. But every time they give it out, some people just like, they don't even listen to what ICT says, and they just assemble it how they think they need to assemble it. Right. And it's all messed up. And then they start messing with the textures and stuff. And it's like, wait a minute. You have scientifically acquired data. Apply it scientifically, you know? Right.
So, well, but then part of the problem too is that they don't.
They're never
going to. Well, it's where it ends, right? They know what they've captured. They've got the method for giving you a diffuse albedo map and a specular, you know, an isolated specular map. And then they're, you know, obviously getting into the geometry, but that, you know, it's never been like, oh, and here's a shader that, you know, puts those things together. Right. It's like, you guys, this is as far as we can go in terms of what we can capture.
Well, now we're giving him a shader. So he's like, here's the way it works. And that shader will be somewhat, you know, fairly universal. I've seen it being used in
just
in
as a starting point.
Yeah,
that's great.
So but one of the stories that Eric told me is obviously when you guys were on Buttons, I mean, and we've kind of told the Button story a lot, so I don't want to get too much into it, but you guys did a lot, right? And it looking really good, and the show was kind of considered pretty much finaled, and then you guys looked at the whole thing, and I guess in Fincher's office or a few of you and like unfinaled several A lot of the shots. And then it was like a skeleton crew going back and let's redo these things, right?
Yep. And when they were redone, it's exactly what we just talked about. They were redone just using the light kit. Throwing everything away.
Those were old shots where you guys were still messing around, trying out new stuff or whatever.
And the HDR had been hacked to pieces, you know, so the lighting wasn't true to what it was, art directed rather than just what was in the actual scene,
right?
You know, and so it was really just going back to what the actual set was. It's like there's, you know, a reason Fincher is Fincher, and you know that.
Yeah,
those plates looked beautiful.
Was Claudio the DP on that?
Claudio was,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, that was a little bit painful.
Yeah.
But it was good.
And that was all shot on Viper. Am I right?
That was.
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah, it was.
I remember it was kind of a really good camera at the time. I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure Viper's got some, I don't know, but I remembered it was like, it was hard to debare that stuff.
It had some really awful, like low light noise. Like, I don't know if you remember the church tent scene when Benjamin learns to walk, that was like 42 shots. And that, it was just, pretty painful, that footage, because we had to neutralize it out, and Fincher even wanted more of actually a neutral grade than this really yellowy tungsten look, and that went through, who's the company that oh my goodness, I can't remember them, who actually denoises, you know, they denoised that footage and restored it. It was actually
really?
Yeah, and they'd done that on Zodiac.
Okay.
Man, I can't remember
their
names.
I don't know.
Price Pethel. Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay.
But it was, some pretty bad footage in the the underexposed stuff. But still beautiful in the end.
Well, that was, I remember, you going, you know, doing Buttons. I think it was really, really impressive work. Obviously, we know the results of that and the accolades that the company had. But I think that was kind of an interesting thing for you, because I think that sort of, besides now, you've gone from like, all right, I'm going to learn how to be a compositor. Now I'm compositing supervisor on Benjamin Buttons, and I'm learning everything about Digital Humans, and you know, sort of leading that process from the 2D point of view, which was really, really cool. then I guess what happened after that? Didn't you end up floating around a little again?
After that, I started Tron, but decided to take off after that. So I went to Method as a visual effects supervisor.
Right. That's right, because you showed up just as I was leaving to go back on Tron.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember he's like, you left Tron, and I'm like, I'm leaving, I'm going on Tron. And so you and I switched, and it's like, why are you leaving? I just wanted to work with you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
It was kind of a whole different methodology, and it just felt like a good note to kind of go on Benjamin Button.
Right.
I later actually ended up coming back on to Tron to help deliver.
Yes, and you and I were hanging out in Toronto.
Yes,
for Mr.
that's
X.
correct. So we did 300 shots up there at the end to finish Tron, and then came back down to help the commercial division had, I think, they had really spread at Tron at the end. It's like there was a lot of different people working on shots.
Yeah.
And so a lot of different groups. And so I was kind of bouncing around. But yeah, I went to Method, and that was awesome. It was a really cool change.
Yeah.
And I think one of the very first projects I worked on was called I'm Here. Mm-hmm. And that's Spike Jonze's short film.
Oh, right.
And it's like a robot love story.
Uh-huh.
It's funny because it's... it was almost the opposite of Button, but it still had the same heart, to it. It was like the characters did. The characters were amazing, but it was a very lo-fi, Spike is a very lo-fi sort of director who doesn't love visual effects. He's warming up to them now. But
Sure. Well, okay. That doesn't mean, well, you know what? Let me just put it. Jon Favreau used to hate visual effects, and now look at Jungle Book, right?
So, exactly.
Like, it's almost all visual effects. Because I remember when I was at Sony, I guess he was working.
It doesn't mean that he still likes him.
No. But he actually has a very interesting opinion about it. Because when I was at Sony, I remember we were working on Zathura, or they were working on Zathura. I wasn't on the show, but then I remember there was some conflict that he was going on about the way that he wanted to shoot. He's much more of a traditional filmmaker in that way, and he was struggling with the process of visual effects. But, I think at the same time, he must have really figured it out, because obviously he went on to work on 2 Iron Man movies and all that other stuff. So it's not necessarily that he is... there is a good blend when you are a traditional filmmaker and you learn how to work in visual effects and not necessarily let the visual effects guide you, right?
Right.
And then you can still sort of... make it work. And I think, I could see Spike Jonze being...
And it's finding the right, probably the right people that you can trust.
Right.
Who get you when you can't speak in visual effects terms.
Right.
You don't care to, it's like finding those people who speak your language, mm-hmm.
So wait, Spike trust. Was the director on Her as well, right?
He was, yeah.
And so, yeah, all right. So, yeah, we're going to get to Her in a second because I'm really fascinated by that. And specifically Spike. Well, actually, let's just talk about it. So we're going to skip ahead and we can go back if we have to. But you ended up back at DD and then you were working on Her when I was there as well.
I actually brought Her to Digital Domain.
You brought Her to Digital Domain. So you work with Spike.
Yep.
And he connected with you and was like, I'm going to make this film called Her, which was gorgeous.
Yeah. And
absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I love the fact that it looks so... what I also liked about it is the fact that people are saying, oh, isn't it so great they made this entire movie and there was no CG and use it in it. And
I was
like, it's so much CG in it, except that you don't see it. And that's the argument I always use. It's like, if you don't see the CG, that means the CG was really good. And when you do see the CG, sometimes it's because it's bad. And that's why people complain, is because they see the CG. But Her had a lot of CG in it, right?
It did.
Lot of city replacements and stuff like that.
Yeah, a lot of city replacements. Giant Man, like the video games that he plays.
Yep. Yeah.
A lot of little stuff.
Right.
But a lot of graphics that that were actually done in-house up at Editorial.
Okay.
By a couple artists up there. I wouldn't say like a lot, but it didn't have none. I had quite a few, and the cities were definitely enhanced.
Right.
Quite a bit.
So throughout. Was that short film at Method the first time you'd worked with Spike Jonze?
It was.
Okay.
Yep.
And so how did you maintain a relationship with him? How did you how do you come back to you and say, hey, I'm doing this film, Her?
Well, that one ended up becoming just a very personal experience with him and his art director, Sonny.
Yep.
They had actually pulled that, I believe, from another company. And, you know, we had to start it over from scratch, and we were trying to make it into Sundance. And so we had a really short timeline, and it was 20-minute short film, about 350 shots, and we had to recreate the main character's eyes and mouth. And it was a girl and a guy character. So Method New York took the guy character.
Okay.
And then that was headed up by Aaron Hjartarson.
Okay.
If you know him. He's over at Framestar now. Yeah, Aaron.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Autumn. Yeah. Aaron. Yeah. Yeah, he's a super nice guy.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah.
And
he's a big soft Tomash guy, I remember it. Like, he was a huge soft Tomash guy. Yeah.
And so we ended up somehow getting through. You know, it was just fun to bring those characters to life. It was like the actual film itself before the CG just had big gaping holes where the eyes and the mouth were. You know, it was like these big kind of lo-fi robot heads with big black holes. And it actually, the film had a really cold feeling to it, obviously with no emoting faces, you know. And so adding in the eyes and the mouth, like, gave it a lot more feeling.
Right.
And I think that Spike just really appreciated how fast we were able to get it together.
Right.
And then how, you know, he was just really happy with the look in the end. So so we stayed in touch. I'm trying to remember what, I guess her was just the last, it was actually Peter Mavromatis, who's David Fincher's post supervisor, was the post soup helping out Spike on her. And so, you know, he ended up calling me up, and I just happened to have gotten back from Iceland, I want to say. I was working on a couple films in Iceland.
What were you working on in Iceland? I can't remember.
Contraband and Two Guns.
Two Guns, that's right. Yep.
And so, yeah, so then we did her.
Yeah. That was really kind of, I don't know, I like that show. I really wish. And the thing is that that's kind of frustrates me a little bit is that they didn't necessarily want to show too much about how much CG was done on it, right? It was like,
no, they didn't.
They want to pretend like, oh no, it was all beautiful and all shot on camera. No, I don't want to pretend. But they didn't want that to be part of the story, right? They didn't want it to be about the CG in it. So it was really kind of a shame, because I was like, I wanted to showcase, like, look how beautiful CG can be, to the point that you don't even notice that it's there or not there. So that was really kind of, I was a little sad that I couldn't, like, show people that stuff, but yeah, it was cool.
That was the trend at that time, right?
It was a trend.
Oblivion, when they were just hyping that the practical model.
Okay, now the Oblivion thing is different, though, because I'll tell you what, I actually said that we did a test to show people how bad it would be if they actually shot that set with all green screen. So we actually made the CG set. Like, we had the whole set, obviously, because they made CAD files or whatever. And we put green everywhere and ray traced it to show people what a nightmare of reflection of green all over Oblivion it would be, talking them into actually building that for real. So I think it was a much better decision that they did.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, just in terms of the exposure, they...
Oh, they chose that over everything.
They really chose to hype up the fact that they recreated, or, you know...
CG has a bad name, and that's, you know, I had a whole trend of talking...
It's all leveled out now. It was just, there seemed to be, everything was happening at once at that time.
It's getting better. I've done a couple of podcasts called Respect VFX, because there's a lot of people that love to talk how bad movies are because of CG. And I think that what they're doing is they're doing a disservice, because CG is actually better than that, you know. And CG, and when CG is really good, you don't notice it, kind of like her, right? And then when CG is bad, you do notice it. And therefore, they just say the reason the movie's bad is because of the CG, or it could actually just be a bad movie.
Right? Oh, or there's just, I mean, the big blockbusters where CG is what makes the billions of dollars, and those same people probably take their kids to go see all those movies.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons for it. But I don't know. I think that there's a lot of stuff, I mean, that looks really great, and it doesn't, and they don't necessarily want to talk about it, how awesome the CG is, because that's not a serious story. Although I think now, you know, like you said, it is plateauing and doing better. I think the Jungle Book is going to be an example that people are going to look at now, and they're going to be talking about how amazing all the CG is in it.
But, yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. Should be interesting. Should be really interesting. It'll be cool to see that. All right, I have a couple other things I'm going to talk about real quick. So you stuck around DDE when you were doing all kinds. You were basically a freelance VFX supervisor, right?
I was.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were going around doing a bunch of projects, Two Guns and Her and stuff.
Yep.
And you came back to DD for a little. Are you at DD now?
I am.
Permanently? Okay, so you're staff there.
Yep.
You've done some VR projects there, right?
I have.
Yeah. And what's that like? And what are these VR projects? What are you actually doing on the VR side of things?
So the first VR project was called Evolution of Verse.
Yep.
And that is, I'm not sure if you saw that one. It's the all CG, like 3-minute piece that Chris Milk directed.
Yes. And that is the one with the train and the baby and all
exactly.
that stuff.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, how you get the baby pictures from me.
Yeah. Oh, right. So,
were you there when he got this?
Yeah.
Like, I have this habit of sending, Chris Nichols.
We thought you were pregnant.
There's two Chris Nichols at ED.
There was two
Chris Nichols until I left ED. And so Janelle, I guess, had both phone numbers of both Chris Nichols, including me and the other one. And you were sending reference pictures of babies.
Oh, man.
Born.
Brand newborn. Really gruesome.
Like out of the womb.
Straight out of the womb.
And so all of a sudden I'm in line at the lunch truck trying to get lunch, and I was like, oh, there's a text from Janelle. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah.
And I was like, did Janelle just have a baby and she wants to show me these pictures?
Yeah.
That was so funny. I was in like a little mini review in my office. And
I thought you selfied your child's birth and then sent it to like everybody. I was like, and I was like, that's awesome.
The pictures were so gruesome because we were actually, you know, deciding like how much stuff that you want
after birth.
Yeah, exactly. After the baby. And so it was like, you know, a little bit, lots, even more blood and stuff everywhere. And so, so you're like, wrong Chris Nichols, I think. And I'm like, oh shit, sorry about that.
Yeah, we laughed.
That was
it off.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, once I saw it, I was like, all these pictures. And then I saw one, it was like a Getty image. And I was like, oh, okay, it's reference. Get it.
Yeah. So anyway, Evolution of Verse, I'd done a CG baby in the womb for a PSA for heart disease with Chris Milk. And Spike had referred referred Chris Milk to me.
Uh-huh.
So we did that spot together. And then Chris Milk was like, hey, have you ever done anything VR? Like, let's do something VR.
Right.
And so... we concepted out a few ideas, and then he came back with this really cool treatment and some different ideas, and we kind of just dove into it, and it was something that Digital Domain was really wanting to get into at the time, but we hadn't yet, and it was a really good just starting point to just forge a pipeline, you know, to the little bit of dev we'd done. It was like, let's just go for it.
Yeah.
And so it was it was pretty cool in typical commercial style. It was like, you know, 360 render for, you know, we used every render we had, you know. And we actually ended up working on that. God, I want to say we started it in July, worked on it all the way up until like December or so. At that point, and that was all Digital Domain, is the main funder in that. And then Annapurna actually joined in as a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the end, it was a Digital Domain Annapurna partnership.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, gave a new infusion of cash, and we were able to kind of take everything we'd learned in the last 6 months and almost do a redo on like, you know, half of it, and get it out in time for Sundance.
Right.
And so that premiered at Sundance, and then that also opened Verse. So, you know, they started Verse Tools and Verse Works with that as their, you know, kind of opening piece.
Yeah.
And it went over really well.
Yeah.
And so that was
Verse seems like an interesting company. I'm very interested to see where they go. They're pretty interesting. And I think, you know, like they have different parts of it. Like they have a creative part and a technology part and sort of mix and match, I guess.
Yeah, they rep, you know, a lot of directors.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to them lately, but you know, they do a lot of documentary type things, you know, almost more so than CG. Like that's by far the most CG piece that they've done.
Right.
But it was really hard. VR's, you know, it was definitely.
Yeah, it's a lot more pixels and a lot more problems.
A lot of rendering, you know, stereo, obviously. And it was really painful on the eyes, you know, just reviewing in VR is something that, after.
5 minutes.
Yeah, but, you know, a couple minutes, you know, but we did the next project. Actually, in between, I did a quick Bjork music video.
Oh, nice.
That was also through Verse. That was a VR music video. And then after that...
Is that where she just do a flower or whatever? Is it?
No, she just like multiplies all over. Okay. And you're kind of just standing in the center watching her.
Okay.
And then after that did this Nike VR piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with Adam Berg.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on that one we had Aruna was, you know, leading up the 2D side of things. There was a lot more technical support.
Oh, right, right.
Lupacora was like heavily involved because right as we started to get that project going, I actually had to head out on the set in Thailand for All I See Is You, the film that I just finished.
Okay,
and
right.
So, but after Nike was when I was kind of like, oh, I think I'm going to give up VR until the tech is better because it literally was giving me like headaches, you know, having to review sure. so much bad VR.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, it's hard.
Like when you're in it that much, you know, it just tends to.
Yeah, hurt. I'm suffering so people don't have to suffer later.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. So tell me, what were you doing in Thailand? Tell me about this project.
So Thailand, this is All I See Is You. It's uh-huh. a Mark Forster film
uh-huh.
that we just finished with Blake Lively
yeah.
and Jason Clark. And it's, yeah, it's another one of those that's not really a visual effects film, and yet we did 37 minutes
right.
of VFX. It's about, you know, Blake Lively is a blind woman mm-hmm. who lost her sight when she was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the film, she gains her sight back by having surgery, and then she starts to lose it again. And so much of the film is shot through her POV. And so we have her POV when it's, you know, her blind vision, which is more like vibrational energy, you know, think kind of sound-driven effects.
Mm-hmm.
Really kind of subtle because like it's a challenge to make it not too effects-y. And then, you know, we just carry the viewer through her, you know, her point of view, like through the film.
That's interesting.
I think they're calling it, it's like a psychological drama.
Okay.
And yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm proud of it.
Yeah. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that.
And we just finished. And so which is why I've had a few days off, hence the tan.
Yeah. There you go. That makes sense.
And then,
when is it coming out?
I think it's going to come out in the fall. It's not confirmed yet.
Okay. Well, that would be really... Yeah, okay, so we'll look forward to that for sure. For sure.
But that was a fun one. It was really challenging, you know, because it was a lot of subjective effects,
yeah.
you know, which isn't the norm. It's not... make this photo real thing and put it into here, you know, or add an explosion.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it could kind of be anything.
Sure.
Like her blind vision, you
yeah.
know? And so it was a challenge to figure out what the director wanted it to be,
yep.
you know, and then something that still had continuity and, you know, that didn't pull the viewer out of it.
Yep.
So that's pretty stuff.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I want to talk to you about one last thing. That's going to be a big one. And specifically, so I've done 70 episodes of this podcast or so. And you're probably the third or fourth woman I've had on this podcast.
That's not surprising.
Okay. Not surprising. Right. And the reason it's not surprising, obviously, is very, very low. Now, I also have a lot of guys in the ArcViz side that I've also talked to because we have a lot of our customers are ArcViz people and they're interested in that part of the industry. And that's even worse than in this the VFX side of things. There are actually a lot of great women visual effects artists, and they're out there, obviously. And one of the things I've said is that specifically, I feel that you'll see different, you know, we talked about compartmental departments. Compositing is going to be the biggest concentration of women, generally speaking. And I feel that it's physiologically makes sense because women have a much better perception of color than men do.
Mm-hmm.
They do.
Yeah, but I don't think that's why.
I think it is. To be honest, I think that women are better compositors than men.
Oh, no. I thought you meant why women get into it or why, you know.
No, I think that women are better compositors than men, generally speaking. So they have a higher chance of them getting into it or being tuned to it. But what's even more rare is women taking on a VFX supervisor position. That's extremely rare. In fact, we were even talking about the fact that this year was the first year ever that a visual effects supervisor was nominated for an Oscar as a woman, right? She actually won, which is incredible.
Which is so cool.
And that's great. But it's so, so unbelievably rare, right? So, I mean, I can probably, if you're going to think about visual effects supervisors that are women, there's probably like less than a handful of them that are known in this area. And you're obviously one of them. Why is it hard for women to take on that level of leadership? I mean, I have seen lots of women compositing leads, compositing supervisors sometimes, but actually take on the full-on control of the visual effects in the movie industry.
I kind of knew you were going to ask me something like this, and I don't.
I want to help her out. It's statistically.
Yes.
That's the problem, right? There are the low numbers statistically. So obviously, if there are a small amount of women and a whole shitload of guys, and they're all competing for at the very top of a pyramid, that one position being soup, and statistically, she's less likely to be. I think,
but more women interesting, don't though, climb up to the supervisor.
No, I know. I mean, as in on a whole, I mean, this reflects lots of other industries but I also don't feel like the numbers are that high down in the trenches either. So what is it that industry?
Because
they're still not.
It's like it was pretty rare, I think. When you started out to be interested in like lightwave stuff, right? Why though, right? Like what is it that didn't appeal? What is it about? Is it just because it's spatially like, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, there's also just the being outnumbered. I think a lot of women probably don't even like that, you know, to be so outnumbered by all these guys, you know, that maybe it even is a deterrent from even, getting into it from the beginning. But I think nowadays there's actually a really good mix. It's starting to get better. You know, like when I work up in Vancouver a lot, I'm noticing, I feel like the Vancouver artist pool is a bit younger than down here.
I'm talking about something very specific because I'm not just talking about the artist pool. I 100% agree with it. When I started at DD on Day After Tomorrow, there was like Diana Sear was hired and people were freaking out. It's like, oh my God, there's another girl in the building because there was like only two more, right? It was ridiculous.
Right.
Now, obviously, like I would say a good third of your staff is going to be women.
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. Like why?
There's a lot of female artists in general. In other mediums,
But I think you could say the same thing about other minorities. You know that there's
sure.
You know, like it's
yes,
a hard.
But there's a.
Because when I was thinking about it, when I was like, what is he going to ask me about being a female? The thing is it is only the last like, I don't know. I'd say 3 years that I've been, kind of hardcore VFX souping that. There's been times that I've been like, man, it's kind of hard to be a female right now. It's hard to.
I don't see it. Janelle, you've always been a very, very strong personality. You know, everyone, you're all listening to her on the podcast. She sounds very sweet and gentle. But trust me, Janelle is about as hard-headed and can drive people up the wall with how strong she is. And there's no compromise with Janelle. None.
That's not true.
Well,
you haven't worked with me in a few years. That's something that, it's something that I don't quite think of myself as like, oh, I'm this woman. I'm this woman.
It has nothing to do with you being a woman that you're doing that. I just think that that's the way you are, right? Like, it's the same thing. You were frustrated with the flame artist screwing up everything. And he's like, screw it. I'm going to fix it myself, right? I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this thing work. So you've always had that personality, which I think is fine. Like I said, I don't think you said because I'm a woman I have to prove myself. You don't come off that way to me ever. But I think that there's a way that your specific personality works, right? And if you look at obviously a lot of VFX supervisors, what usually makes them VFX supervisors is that over time they develop relationships with directors, right? So you developed a relationship with Spike Jonze as an example, and so he's going to come back to you to do that. But I think that that's one of the issues, is that all the people at that level, all the director levels, the producer levels, producer not so much, but mostly the director level, creative, DP level, those are all men, right? And so introducing a woman into that mix of people that are making decisions at the top of the food chain and the editors, et cetera, it tends to be rare to have women in that area.
I think it is rare, but at the same time, it's welcome these days, which is which is good, you know. And it, and I think every project that I do now, it's more just reflecting and going, okay, you know, working on being a good leader, working on, you know, creating great imagery, and then working on, like, what can I learn from, like, where these experiences did go wrong, like where, you know, I'm pushing people too hard, or not pushing enough, or, you know, not getting the director what he needs, and, you know, just kind of working on, you know, self-reflecting and figuring out what I can take into the next project.
Right.
To, you know, like Tupac, for instance. Yeah. I was acting
a lot.
Oh,
we forgot to even
Chris
mention Tupac,
is, you know, saying that I used to act. I was pretty bullheaded and, you know, kind of wouldn't take no for an answer and was going to, you know, I was... I didn't really care about those around me, and it was more important that that final, the artist, you know what I mean? But
I
not
mean, it's
the
drive.
Authority.
I mean, I
Okay. So the reason, Janelle is mentioning Tupac is that you were the comp sup on it, or were you the.
Steve Prieg and I were co supervisors.
Right.
On
so Steve Prieg and Janelle, Steve has been also on this podcast. Steve and Janelle were co supervisors on Tupac. Stephen Parker was lighting everything on Tupac. He did all the look, Dev, and lighting.
And Janelle
was a very, small team.
A very small team, and so you pushed Steven.
Man, I didn't give a shit. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, I just, you know, you had drive, and I appreciated it, and I knew that if I was going to be on with something, you were going to,
You don't take
But I'm saying, even from a political standpoint of what,
right. but
in
I
the
did,
facility
But I'll
was.
Say this, that when I first started at DD, it was Tron, and you hadn't left yet, and my seat was right next to you. And I remember, and Lit was over there and a few other people. And I remember a lot of the conversations you were having. And it was, you know, the thing is, like, you were in a certain mindset, and it might have been defensive, but that's because you kind of had to be. Because I do feel like a lot of the conversations where people seem to be trying to undermine you or something, or they were just looking at you like you were a climber, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like,
no, it's harder. You get judged a lot, you know.
Right,
you,
right.
You definitely get prejudged.
Because you had a lot of, like, salty people who had been comping there, you know. Especially on the feature side. So you were coming. You had a lot of things stacked against you. I mean, I kind of, like, I don't know, I always appreciated how you kind of just put your head down and barreled through that shit. Because, you know, there was a lot of political things happening. And I think that the, and maybe not, you know, not... Not overtly, but it's just, there's just a lot of things that's sort of stacking up or leading up to that point or whatever. And then when you took off, you know, that was probably the best thing to do at the time. I mean, you went off and took a better, you know, took an opportunity, learned from that, whatever, came back, you're back, and now, you know, comfortable where you are. And probably not a lot of people trying to, you know, undermine you or get in your way or whatever.
No, I mean, and it's... I think I need to think about it more, like what it means to be a female in my position and appreciate my position where I'm at and how I can actually be more of a...
I know it's an odd question because I don't actually... I never seen it as an issue with you in the sense that that was never like, well, look at that, you know? I never thought of you as like...
But I went through this whole evolution, right? I used to want to be one of the guys, you know, had to be one of the guys. And then it was, you know...
That it was that part of it what allowed you to get through that hump is like trying to be one of the guys or at least understanding one of the guys or whatever that is.
I don't think that was absolutely necessary. Like, I would mentor, you know, girls under me now to just be themselves, you know.
Okay.
I think that now I just be me, you know, and that's what I try to do.
Right.
Even when, you know, I think that sometimes females get more analytical or, you know, worried or, you know, thinking about too many small little things.
Yeah.
And it's not worth it, you
I'm
know.
I'm not going to say emotional.
It's better to just, you know.
But
to
you know what I mean?
No.
Be you. And it's not that, you know, it's a very quick psychology lesson of girls versus guys, of what, you know,
how,
and that most people, when they get into the industry, have already taken that psych class. And so I don't think that it's really that important to be one of the guys. It's more important. And I think that we actually need more female energy, you know, in the industry.
So I'm going to bring that.
I think every workplace does. I mean,
the other place that you see a lot more women is in the production side of things, right? So producers, coordinators, you know, DPMs, et cetera, those people that are worrying about production. What's that?
Well, go ahead. I'm just sorry. Okay. This kind of leads into what I was saying earlier.
Okay. Those people tend to do very well. Women tend to do very well in those positions. And there's one of the big reasons is they tend to be a little bit more organized than men, right? And they also tend to be a little bit more nurturing, right? And so they're like, okay, I'm going to get this person to do their work, and I'm going to give them all the things they need to fulfill their stuff. And I don't necessarily. I think that is a strong female characteristic of being more nurturing and being more in that way of doing things.
Well, managing
and managing,
you know. And I think that's something that I struggle with. That I'm working on is like not to micromanage, you know, to really trust those, you know, the team,
right?
And you know, and not actually go into that micromanager role, you
right.
know, and that's. Yeah, it's easy to kind of fall into that.
Yeah.
You know, which is what in production is needed. You
production
know,
but
as
needs
a visual
effects
supervisor.
Don't worry, I'll take care of the details for you, and then you can do your job. And that's yeah. Yeah. And that's actually been tough for me because I've been, you know, I've been babysat for a long time as a, you know, a lighting supervisor or CG supervisor or even a VFX supervisor, because I had great coordinators, right? They took care of everything for me and I didn't have to worry about it. Now when I'm in my job, I don't have a coordinator right now, and I am struggling, and I'm realizing the value of having someone that just like knows how to just make sure shit's working, you know, and therefore I can just do what I have to do in terms of the decision-making portions of things. And I think that's a strong one as well. But I want to go back to what you were saying about you mentoring young female artists out there. So how do you, what's some of the things you use to mentor them?
I mean, I don't think I even.
I mean, you probably don't even
label
think about it,
right?
You don't label them as women,
it.
Right?
But it's just something where I don't. Yeah, I don't really know. I just try to lead by example, you
right.
know. And I think,
but
with,
you did mention, like, you know, you see, you know, just be yourself, right? You do say that, right?
Yeah. Well, I find that a lot of the, you know, a lot of the girls who are on, you know, we had some amazing, like, an animator. Compositor, lighter, you know, on the last show mm-hmm. that we just finished. And I think that they're a lot more, you know, evolved. Like there wasn't any, I didn't have to say that to them. You
so
know,
you
they
think,
were very confident
so
and they were very talented.
You feel that over time, because obviously we've been doing this shit for a long time, right? And so you were in that, you were, you know, in the early, you know, early 2000s, right? There wasn't that many women in general in VFX. And maybe just now over time, that's how you, maybe that's what you're saying, is that percentage wise, by the time that she's gotten there, there's not been that many women in visual effects.
Right.
And that over time, just because there's a larger population of women on the lower ranks right now, because there's more interest in women, that over time those people will become visual effects supervisors, so there will be a higher percentage.
Right. I think fundamentally what I meant was, what is it about computers that draws guys? Like, what was it about those the early days where you're, you know, making a sphere in a computer and trying to render it. Like, what is it about computers that draws guys that, you know, to them, or you just want to sit in front of one and either program it or use it to make something that women didn't necessarily get drawn to right away? Like, you were kind of an exception to it, right? And maybe it's still the case, just like we just talked about the production side of the jobs. I don't think it's just...
But
I think that
I mean,
people,
probably
I think that
stems
men and women
how,
gravitate towards certain types of jobs, right?
But it probably depends on how you're raised and how, you know, culture, you know, mm-hmm. what influence culture has on you. And, you know, I think more and more that is evolving, you know, and
right.
so you're going to see more and more.
I guess. I mean, my older daughter, I just tried to, she does not care about computers. I'm like, it's the only thing I can teach you other than how to throw a baseball.
I know, I'm having a problem with my,
but she's like, she does not into it. And she paints, she loves, you know, oil paint or whatever. She's probably a little bit more into music, but she does not, I mean, she uses them all day long, but in terms of like.
Yeah, I'm not sure if like, you know, I'm sure that Yeah, there's a much higher percentage of men with like analytical, mathematical brains.
I think there's some psychological component to
that. Yeah, I know. I keep thinking it's like, I don't know what you're talking about, because I keep talking about my wife who's like, she was a math major too. She, you know, does stuff. She programmed in COBOL. She does crazy.
Right.
So she's a flame artist.
So she's always done things.
So to me, it's like, I don't understand. Women are like, it's like my wife. I was like, okay, maybe my wife is
not the norm.
And Janelle is either.
Right. No,
I agree.
Right.
I mean, you've always been sort of.
But then it makes it tough because if you have interests that, you know, are outside of the norm or whatever, then you're going to be, it's an uphill battle.
And I mean, I think, you know, women, thanks, man. I think that women tend to be a little more passive. And so even if they're extremely talented, every single one of their shots, you know, just hits it out of the park. They're really good. Mm-hmm. They don't tend to like want to go for the leadership role because, you know, it's something that's a little scary, or I know it was for me originally, you know.
That I agree. I think that you're right.
And part of it might even be that they're having to lead a bunch of guys, you know, for the most part. And that's a little, you know, it's something that's just a little
Now we're getting something
intimidating and tricky.
I think you're right, because I have seen, like, there's a lot of star female athletes or artists, right? So there's a lot of star female artists out there who are like best compositor, blah, blah, blah. And you go through the list of these amazing female compositors or modelers or whatever. But they sometimes will lead like a small team, you know, but they don't lead a big team. They don't necessarily go for the CG superpositions, or like they certainly don't go for a DFX supervisor position sometimes. But I think you're right. It's like it's a little bit more intimidating for a girl or a woman, sorry, to lead a bunch of guys. I think.
Well, it's just not that fun, you know, sometimes, you know,
for the guys or for the girl.
I don't know, maybe both.
Maybe,
but
just
you know,
leadership in general in this industry is not that.
Well,
much
and
fun.
It actually,
you'd rather,
I mean,
be on the
kind
box
of hit
doing,
on a good point. Like, I think that I don't know, in so many other industries, like leadership is taught. There's a lot more, you know, that goes into training someone to manage and be a leader.
Sure.
And, you know, in this industry, it's just kind of like, good luck, you know. And I know when I went to ILM, I was there for, you know, only like 4 or 5 months,
right,
comping on Cowboys and Aliens. And it was great because they actually had all these amazing classes, you know, for leadership, for anything,
really?
Sculpting. Yeah, nice. it was so cool. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just found that to be really incredibly helpful.
Good.
And, you know, because a lot of my reviews were kind of like, you know, you're a great compositor, you're not a good leader, but not here's how to lead, you know? and so that's...
I think in an environment like that, it usually comes down to diplomacy and I don't know. I've always felt your style of leadership was perfectly fine. But you know,
I think, yes, a lot of people are very...
I prefer directness. But a lot of times, you know, you're talking about... aside, like you're talking to an artist... Artists tend to be sensitive, particularly when it comes to their work. You're like, you don't take criticism that well. It's like one of the first things you learn in architecture. Right?
I know, exactly.
They tear you up. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
That was the best lesson I ever learned.
People cry.
Yeah, architecture school.
Because you put all this time in to something and you're, you know, and just to have somebody come in and just shit all over it, because it's a lot of it is subjective.
I had the dean of the architecture school that lit a model on fire because he thought it was the worst design ever.
That's awesome.
but if you don't have, you know, the kind of kid gloves that you need, because you are working with
artists, and there are sometimes, you know, you know this sometimes you get like artists and you're like getting upset and they're like getting really, really sensitive about their shot, or you have to pull it away from them, and it's just like,
oh my god, pulling a shot from somebody. Yeah, that's,
I've done it.
And yeah. it's the worst thing you could do.
I know. It's tough to do, but it's like, you know,
all the little bullshit reasons you have to give. You know,
No.
Oh, we're going to give you this other shot. It's like much more.
Well, here's what I do. And to be honest, I remember there are certain artists that I struggle with. It's you don't want to pull the shot because you're like kind of being a pussy about it. It's like, I don't want to deal with the actual problem of telling this person and I'm pulling the shot. So you delay it, right? Like any other awkward conversation.
Right.
But here's what I always do. I say, listen, you wouldn't be on my team. You wouldn't be with me if I didn't trust you and I didn't think you were awesome as a person and what you're doing. You are struggling right now and you're making your life hell and you're not having fun. So I'm going to take this shot away from you so that you can have fun again. And I'm going to give it to someone else so that they can just look at it with fresh eyes, because it's going to be impossible for you to look at this fresh
again.
That's
nice of you.
And I do that. Well, I do that.
Because I tend to... I don't, shots shouldn't, people should not take such ownership over a shot. They need to take ownership, but they need to, I think that it's better for the whole team to own, because it's not just a shot, it's the sequence.
Well, that's a great other
it's
thing.
Continuity, it's like, you know, like, yeah, of the whole, of all of the effects. And, right. And you know, so it, I don't know, I like for it to not be a huge deal if so-and-so has to, you know, take a look at this yeah. other shot, you know, because they have a shot similar and it's already finaled. And so they're going to take a look and here's three more that you need to look at, you know.
And I've had artists who looked at me and say, thank you so much for doing that. You know, yeah. like because they actually didn't want to be on the shot. And you were like afraid to take it away from them because they're going to hurt their feelings even more because they look upset. Sometimes they actually want to not be on that shot anymore.
But don't want to admit defeat.
Right.
Right.
But by you saying, don't worry, we're just doing it. It's like, oh, okay, fine. Well, there we go. We're moving on. But I think, okay, so I'm already getting some pieces of good information that I think is cool, like leadership classes. That was a good one. I think that that would be good for people. I think actually anyone, doesn't matter of your gender, obviously, but to take that role.
Right.
It helps. It was silly little things like how to write emails, you know, and,
yeah,
you right. know, just
yes.
stuff that kind of seems common sense when you
place with
look
a real
back on
HR
it,
department. But,
what's that?
Places with a real HR department.
Well, just with a, you know.
I mean, that's how
I don't
the
know
rest,
if they still have that or
to,
not.
How to
know?
Backstab your boss and take over
that's
his
how
position.
The rest of, yeah, yeah. Like my wife worked in publishing and that's, yeah. Professional development was always like a priority. Like yep. places that they invest in that, right? But like in visual effects, I mean.
Well, it's pretty rare.
You got to learn how to have conversation with your clients too,
you know,
right?
You're not running a corporation.
You got to be able to be a respectful voice, be able to move forward, show that you can take on decision making for them. And I know there's a lot of things that are important in that area. And then so there's communication on the upside and communication on the downside.
Yep.
Because you have or you know, client side and then artist side, and those are very different conversations.
Yep.
Very much.
And they're interesting too. You know, I don't know. Eric Barba is a lot of people don't necessarily think to have a hard time with him because he is very forceful and very emotional about his stuff and takes a lot of things very personally. Like he what were you saying earlier about him? You're saying he's
personally invested.
He personally invested.
Even he, you know, has evolved.
Sure.
You know,
oh, he totally is.
Absolutely. Yeah, like yeah. when on Tron, he was getting very offended when someone would get upset and leave the show. Yeah, like I'm sure he didn't with you. but then after a while, he was like, yeah, no, it's all good. You know,
yeah,
everyone's got to evolve.
That's the biggest thing that it's good for people to remember that everyone evolves, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so to try not to hold grudges too long and
oh, yeah.
forgive and, you know, because there's always just the next show and it's a new slate, you know.
I believe it or not, I used to be even more emotional and part of things very personally and got really upset. But I do think that like you brought it up, like architecture school was like the best lesson of just nothing is precious. Don't worry about it. Tear your shot apart. Doesn't matter. Because you can take that criticism, you know? Definitely.
Yeah, maybe that's why it wasn't such a big deal because...
Architecture school.
Like, yeah, I spent a couple of years kind of going through that shit. And it's subjective, yeah. and you know it is, and eventually you tell yourself that is the case. So you don't take it personal, but you like, you know, some of those things would just take so much time to do, you know.
So here's another thing I'm going to talk about, and maybe Janelle, you can agree or disagree with me, but one thing that happened in architecture school, I had the dean of the architectural school, very strong personality. Small architecture school, Rice was very small. So we kind of knew, everyone knew each other, right? The dean was there. I was presenting some project and it was the early days of rendering stuff. So I was doing all the stuff on computers and everyone's like, oh, Chris is going to do some computer rendering for his architecture. And they're all very excited about it. But I was presenting this stuff and I was doing, you know, talking, giving the whole story about my project. And I don't know, it wasn't that great a project for sure. But then the dean was saying, like, yeah, yeah, you keep telling the story. And he listens, literally, what do you say? You keep telling these kind of stories, but all you're doing is sitting there presenting all these computer pictures and whatever. I don't see it. It's like, it's what you're doing here is you're presenting pornography, where basically I don't give a crap about the story. I just want to see the pictures.
Wow.
And he said that to me, like, that's what he would say to me, right? And I was like, it was harsh criticism, right? And he's like, it's just pornography. CG is pornography. And I was there. It's like a room full of people in the jury room. I don't know if we have jury rooms, which is basically like a theater. Anyone in the school can watch a jury happen because you learn the process of discussing design. And I had my notebook in the middle of the thing. And it was like, everyone, the whole school is watching. I slammed down my notebook on the ground and I said, I'm tired of it. He says, I am tired of the fact that you guys keep talking about my renderings and about CG. It says, I am bringing this stuff here. I'm doing stuff. I'm learning stuff. You guys work for me. You are the teachers. I'm paying for tuition. Wow. Says, you're here to learn, to teach me. Yeah. If you want me to learn how to make better design, you have to teach me and not just tell me that my stuff is pornography. And he, like this whole thing, like I was like, oh shit, Chris just talked to the dean of the school about like that way. And I was like, yep. And then, anyways, and everyone is like, well, that's it. You know, Chris's career at Rice is done. And then, no, absolutely not. Because Lars, the dean came up to me, he's like, yeah, I like that. Got some guts on you. And so he became my main advisor for my thesis. No one was shocked. It's like, you have Lars Lerp as your advisor for your thesis? It's like, yep.
Wow.
And I think that's the point, right? Because I continue to do that. I'm not afraid to speak up to leadership. If it's appropriate, if I can try to get good feedback, right? So I spoke up to Eric if I thought it was appropriate, if I had a problem with things, right. You know? And he responded appropriately. Like, yeah, sure, he fought me on it, as he should, you know, because that's the whole point of a debate is getting each other's point of view across. But I think that the ability to
I think the artist should speak up.
Yeah.
I think that there's... you know, I know that I've been told that my style is much more collaborative. It's
okay.
Like I'm in dailies. It's just very much a group effort. You
yeah.
know, like even in Benjamin Button or Tupac days, it was like, what does the receptionist think about this? Does she think
right.
Does she think it looks real?
Well, that's an important part of digital humans, right? Because that's the thing about digital humans, like. Sometimes you're so close to it, but the fact is that if it's wrong, even your grandmother knows it's wrong, right?
Yeah, but I mean, even visual effects in general, though, you know,
yeah.
It's even sometimes, it's just whether it's the coordinator or whoever it might be, it's especially important for the artist who's working on the shot to speak up and to push back on me or to actually, you know, give a suggestion or, you know, that it's kind of this back
right.
and forth I think that's really important. It makes things go so much faster and, you know, the end product is a lot better.
Yep.
And so I think that there's a lot more of a dictatorship in a lot of visual effects suits.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That
yeah.
With Eric, I always, and he was honestly my visual effects supervisor most of the time. Like I would always speak up, so I didn't witness a lot of that.
He does say that. He said he went in to make sure everyone was in the screening room all the time. And a lot of people were like, oh, I got work to do. I'm in the screening room. It's like, well, participate, make that part of your thing. And he did do that to some extent. But I think, to be honest, I even saw an evolution from when I started on Tron all the way through Oblivion. At the beginning of Tron, sure, everyone was there, but I don't know how much other opinions were welcome.
Right.
But by the end, he definitely welcomed opinions.
Yeah.
You know, a lot more. And he definitely, he's evolved in that process. Like you said, everyone evolves, right? And it's also the fact that by the time I was working with him on Oblivion or whatever else I was working on, I can't remember, but everyone on that team had been working with him for years. So everyone knew how to communicate. It wasn't like, someone,
right.
You know, so I think that's also a thing is the relationships you build with all of the artists and the clients and everything else. You know, Eric knows how to communicate with Joe Kaczynski, and he knows how to communicate with Fincher.
Yeah, relationships are key.
Yeah, and then the way you communicate with Spike Jones, I'm sure, is very similar, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, it's cool. Well, we're way over. which is awesome.
We're always over. It's like
it's getting like, that. It's becoming a theme. And I always say the thing is like when I tell people, I was like, "Well, your podcast is super long." It's like when it's long, it's because it gets good.
It's because we're hanging out and there's
I
no
like
format.
How confident
right?
You yeah. guys are.
It works well. The one with Daniel Lay went really long. I think that one went almost 2 hours.
Yeah. That's the soldier.
Yeah, the right. Right. soldier. He was a the soldier.
I feel like we only scratched the surface of on that one with
oh,
him.
Yeah.
I feel like,
but we also drank a lot of scotch or whiskey at that
oh,
time.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, it was good. It was fun. So I really appreciate it. We're gonna definitely give me some links of stuff we can show up there. Maybe we won't put Den Bakker up there.
Oh my god.
If you
no.
can find it, right? Can you still find it?
Don't look.
But we'll definitely look. Obviously, the Benjamin Buttons thing is real, is fabulous, and some of the other stuff. Yeah,
I had one. I forgot because I forgot about the James Brown test.
James Brown.
Do you remember
way,
that?
Way, way back.
Way
when.
Back.
This was like in 90s.
Yeah, or late 90s, I don't know.
No, yeah, it was James Brown. I think it was Ed Ulbrich was like brought that thing in. Yeah. And that
did
was a DB thing.
Yeah, and did we not bring that up for reference?
For, did we?
No, I don't think so.
No,
anyway,
I
took a totally, for, I mean, because we were talking about it.
That's
anyway,
a little out of left fielder.
I know, sorry, these things pop in my head that way. It's
James Brown.
It's my age. But anyway, no, that was.
I don't think I ever saw that.
We should see if that's out there. Let's try and find that.
Okay. It's not necessarily relevant to this podcast, though. We could find who did it. Oh,
I'd love to see it.
Maybe what we can do is we can get Ed Ulbrich on the show and on the podcast.
All right.
And then we'll talk to him about James Brown.
All right.
How's that sound?
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Except that Ed is fairly busy, so I'm not sure he's going to answer my calls. All right. So,
well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on. And we'll go ahead and let the last bucket drop us. That's the sign off of the podcast, by the way. All right. Thanks, guys.